Well, hi, everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Ciaffardini. Thanks so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Fire up your symphonies. Get your strings warmed up. Tune your instruments. We are going to fly to heights, both high and low, upper crust and down and dirty, criminal underworlds and battlefronts. We're going to speak to composer, music editor, conductor, coordinator, really tall guy, Chris Benstead. He is Guy Ritchie's secret weapon in the pocket, in the ankle, pulls it out of the back of his, like a, you know, Mossberg shotgun. We are going to have so much fun talking to him about the music that he's given to the world of Guy Ritchie films and TV shows, and also everything else before that. He's got so much on his plate. Chris, how are things in your world?
Things are good, yeah. What I'm interested to know is how do you know I'm tall? This is an interesting. have you been doing some sleuthing here?
Or well, by the fact that you put your speakers at about 4.5 feet, and now that based on the perspective, I'm just going off of a photo from I think it was a BAFTA or maybe and you were with three other guys who might have been Munchkins. We're not sure.
They were not particularly gifted with great height. Let's be honest. But maybe that's I was. I don't know if it's a good thing or not. Really. Anyway.
Well, as they say in that famous sci-fi adventure from the 80s, you are tall in stature and wide in vision. We are thrilled to have you on the show today. So why don't we get to some getting to know you questions? What was the first thing that popped into your ear and made you think, I have to put my hands on that? That looks fun on stage, whether it's a saxophone or, you know, cello.
Oh, I see what you mean.
So what first caught your attention at a young age?
What was it? I think keyboard was my starting point. Thought that was an interesting thing to get involved with. And, you know, sort of, I was into anything gadgety. So kind of, you know, having a Casio keyboard was quite a thing. And then that sort of soon progressed into sort of, you know, getting a proper PC with a sound card and starting to doodle around. I remember actually one of the first things I did, I just remember this, was I found this, there was this sample library of different quotes and little sentences from Star Wars. So I sort of made some dance tracks out with little clips of Star Wars dialogue. Probably absolutely terrible, come to think of it. Yeah, and then I kind of got inspired by Britpop in the UK. Started playing the guitar and sort of wanted to be in bands for the longest time, to be honest. That was my thing. I really wanted to be a singer and a guitar player and a, you know, musician in that kind of sense. But alongside that, I was given a violin when I was like maybe 9 or 10. And it became evident that my fingers were too big for that, even at that age. So it was suggested that I should play the cello. So I upgraded pretty sharpish to a cello, I think, when I was 11 or 12. And so then sort of classically sort of learned the cello and just kind of fell in love with that strand as well. So it's these two things, you know, from sort of quite into rock music, but also into classical music. And then later I became really interested in jazz at uni, you know, played in big bands and stuff like that. So yeah, it's quite a diverse range of sort of music really that I'm into.
And I think just everything you said I started to see these intangible red lines, like a spy movie, like, okay, well, cello, that was a driving factor in the Covenant soundtrack, and the big band music, that was the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. And then I don't know, like, you know, when you had the keyboard as a young age, I don't know where that lands, but it's got to be somewhere.
Boss a beat, yeah, had all the presets. Me, I was loving life. I was free agent back then, could do anything musically. Wow. You're right. And I think it's funny how those things kind of fall into place. Like I was also a fan of musicals. Like my sister was into dance and we loved like Grease and stuff like that. And also some of the Menken Disney stuff. I think I had Aladdin on cassette, which was pretty cool. I sort of remember listening to that quite ferociously. And then actually I was in a production of Little Shop of Horrors at one point. I actually played Seymour. I don't know how that was possible. So I kind of like to perform as well. But yeah, it was amazing then to meet Alan Menken, but to actually work with him on some music was absolutely ridiculous. Redonkulous. Loved it.
you know, as a musician, I think it goes two ways. You either have extreme courage where your balls out, you know, shirt off playing saxophone, or you're in the back playing the timpani. I hope nobody sees me. So it seems like you're on the former rather than the latter, but where does the confidence come from? Where's the, I can do this keyboard, question. I can do the cello, I can do whatever. Where's that energy and gusto come from?
I don't know where it comes from. I think it's getting a buzz out of what you're doing and people then sort of going, oh, he's all right at that. And that gives you a little bit of confidence, right? And then it's just sort of spirals from there. You know, obviously, I guess some people have a musical aptitude and some don't, right? And some people are more performative in general than others. So I guess I just kind of embrace that, you know, and just love being around music and drama and all those things at school, really. And then really sort of deeply fell in love with various forms of kind of rock music in my teen years, yeah.
What was the first album that you got that maybe your parents, if they knew, you probably shouldn't be listening to that?
Yeah, I don't think I ever went that. I wasn't sort of Pantera guy or sort of like Slipknot. I didn't sort of veer into Slipknot. I was more kind of, just going back in time. I think one of the first albums I really loved was Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill. Don't you remember that? This is such a, I thought it was just an absolute tour de force of songwriting. And I remember I used to do my paper round. Do you know what that? Do you have that? Is that a thing in America?
No.
You know, like delivering newspapers.
Oh, paper route. Okay, something like
that. Paper round. Sorry, it's my accent. Listening to Jagged Little Pill, and various other things, and then I was sort of big into grunge, which I think came through. You know, you said these little dots start to link on your board there on your wall. I think one of those dots was a sort of Nirvana influence in The Covenant. You know, there's certainly. I was a big fan of grunge. I was in a few sort of failed grunge bands with other friends. You know, it is when you're a teenager, you're like, oh yeah, I'll be in a band with you. And 3 weeks later, you're like, this dude can't even play any kind of drum beat. He's rubbish. So you're like, all right, okay, that was the Nirvana stage over. No, but it was a bit more of a love affair than that. But yeah, so that was an interesting little sojourn into grunge, for sure.
Well, I was huge into Pearl Jam's 10 album. And I don't know if you agree with this about Alanis Morissette. I found that, I mean, that was unstoppable.
Yeah.
95, 96. But out of the five or six singles that hit airwaves repeatedly, I almost thought that the six that you didn't hear on the radio were even better than Ironic and Head Over Feet. And
what I mean. There was such depth to the album. And it's funny because... Yeah, it was super commercial, but there was such a unique sort of clarity to it. And I think that's why I loved it. And another band I absolutely loved, they weren't very big in America, was the Manic Street Preachers. Do you know the Manic Street Preachers?
No,
they're a British band.
I don't think so.
But they had some amazingly good string arrangements, which I absolutely adored. So somehow, I guess this idea of mixing classical orchestra with a band did appeal to me because I love that album. I think it was called Everything Must Go. Is it Steve? I forget the name of the, it might be Steve Hedges, the string arranger. That was amazing. And also I loved S&M, you know, the Metallica album with the San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, they come out in 99, 2000, something like that.
Must be that. Yeah. But again, so that was another little blending of my two worlds, you know, the guitar with the cello, right? As it were, you know, the orchestra with the band. So I try and sort of live by that mantra when I'm writing now, to try and not to think of it as, I think you either get two forms of score. I know people call it kind of hybrid score. You kind of get an orchestral score with bits of like drum kit and bandy influence. And that always comes across a bit cheesy to me. And then the other side of it, you sort of get a fully band driven with a bit of something wafting in the background, a bit of orchestra. So I almost try and make the two things equal at times. You know what I mean? It's like, And that's a way of kind of producing and mixing too, obviously, because you've got this very close recorded band with a much more diffuse orchestra. So it's how do we make this a cool kind of tight sound, which I think Wrath of Man was my sort of experiment on that one, which I loved.
Well, I love that you're diving into this already. I mean, there's a bunch of these questions
sorry,
that
I'm
we're
going,
already starting
I'm
to hit on. No, this is, hey, yeah, you just, be the interviewer. I'll just sit back and watch what happens.
No, you're good.
No, but if you think of like... Aerosmith's Dream On. That was a song that was done with a lot of theatricality, a lot of symphony. And, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned that about your pursuits, specifically about the Covenant. It reminded me of, I was going to say Metallica's S&M, but almost like some rock bands of the late 90s, early 2000s that started to take on that more theatricality, that had instrumentation that was more than just a heavy bass and a guitar. It had that orchestral backing, but it, like you're saying, it did feather well so that it felt, it wasn't cheesy, it was more robust. So
yeah, that's cool. And I think, yeah, and I sort of flipped it on its head because I wanted to do something grungy, and I actually played my cello like a guitar, like sat it on my knee and strummed it, because you can strum a cello kind of sat up, but it doesn't really work. So I kind of, you know, playing chords. So, you know, I think the quite a few of those tracks, yeah, it's kind of strummed cello, which is an unusual sound, and it's got there's not much clarity to it. It's kind of a very cloaked sound. So then, yeah, I sort of added orchestra and other elements as those cues grew to kind of give it some grandeur and stature. So yeah, it's a good bit of blending. Put it in the blender.
Was there a hurdy-gurdy in there? What brings that almost Viking primordial sound to it?
Yeah, that's actually Viola da Gamba, which is an old sort of a precursor to the modern string section. It's actually a fretted, it's somewhere between a kind of lute and a violin, so it has frets. So you can't really, because it's fretted, it has frets, you can't do vibrato, so it's a very dead sound, which sounds akin to a hurdy-gurdy. Yeah, and sometimes it's just me on the regular cello, just really dead, just with that feeling. I'm good at that.
You play it with sour face.
Oh mate, absolutely. Get really stoic and then get on the cello. You get some viola da gamba sounds out of it. Yeah,
I think that sounds like a drink that the gentleman order. I want
viola da gamba.
What did Vinnie Jones say? Slow gin, and viola da gamba.
Just crack it in there.
You know, I'm kind of struggling here because you do have so many avenues I want to go down. You know, I have to say that Covenant was one of my top three films and scores of last year. I mean, you barely got beat out by Gran Turismo and Dial of Destiny. But it's like, hey, if you're in that category three, holy shit, you must have done something right. But that was just, I love that score in that movie.
It was unexpected,
it was a good movie, too. Right? And I do love the fact that you're bringing your skill set, because I know that composers are asked to be chameleons, or they might have to, do something that maybe is not in their wheelhouse to sort of fit the story or the director's vision or something. But I love that right off the bat, you're telling me that these things that you have had experience with have become your sort of secret weapons, the things that make you, and that sound is actually manifesting from different projects and narratives. So I think that's cool. There's not really a question there. I just want to say Covenant, badass, everybody see cool. It. The music's freaking awesome.
Yeah, Wicked, yeah. Yeah, it was a cool film, right? And I think it had a real, I think it was the first really serious kind of tone of film that guy's made, you know, had some weight to it. And I think that was really fantastic. And he always sort of guides me with the score to not be over emotional, you know, to always not to overly guide the viewer into feeling sad or feeling, you know, this person's vulnerable, whatever it is. So that was a really, you know, the last sequence, I think I did many versions of that as they, you know, as they kind of reach salvation, as it were, on the way to the US.
Is that the Darunta Dam?
I think it's the one after that. Is it the last track? It might not be okay. Sequential. Yeah. But, okay. Yeah, so that's, sorry, lost my train of thought here.
I'm the worst interviewer ever. I'll just derail your thoughts.
No, you're not. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, crack on.
Well, no, it's also great too, because I think that you know, Guy has a brand. Guy's been to quote Harry Gregson Williams, he's been around the houses. He's Zimmered himself, he's Pembertoned himself, but now he's tethered you through the, I mean, Wrath of Man. If you haven't seen it, just stop what you're doing and just go see it. Just goes to show how you can follow these movies that both the narrative is unexpected It's pensive, and so does the music, and it's just so impacting. But I also love how you got to revisit, now jumping to The Gentlemen, because I have no transitional material. Jumping to The Gentlemen, you went from a film, which, you know, is a contained narrative, and now you get to do something in a TV form, which is in the world, but kind of related, but still free form, and got to be its own upper crust and waltziness through criminal empires. So gentlemen, go. Can we talk? How do you go from the film?
Let's chat, gents. going from the film was an interesting transition, because it's, you know, the film was dark, right? Matthew McConaughey's character was pretty dark. There was a sort of bit of a cloud above him at all times. And the TV series, I think, is quite different in character. You know, I think there's fun in both, but there's a different kind of fun in the TV series. So what the music that I wrote for the film, it was kind of dark in character, had a lot of, kind of sat under the dialogue a lot of the time. But I think what became evident in the series is that we could actually make the music much, the underscore, as it were, my score, much more of a character within itself. And Guy's always really keen for the music to be bold and kind of be heard. He likes to hear the music. He likes the music loud, and he likes it to have an active role. It's not a bystander. It's sometimes pulling you in an odd direction, you know, just to sort of discombobulate. My initial thought was, this is awesome. We can just use the music from the film. This is going to be quick. And then in my first sort of interaction with Guy, he was like, I think we should do something entirely new. So we did. And that was fun, to sort of find a different style, you know. And I think we soon landed on this idea of maybe it should inhabit the sort of classical world to sort of portray the sort of genteel, aristocratic world that Freddie and Eddie come from, and their father and mother. So that was interesting. But then at times to sort of have other tracks which were more edgy, a little bit more urban at times, you know, just to kind of mix it up. But into that mix came the choir, you know, what role can that have? And I think that was sort of unlocked in the scene when Freddie loses his nut, because he realizes he's not going to inherit the family estate. And what really worked was the sort of staccato Latin-esque vocals, which are sort of slightly religious, ecclesiastical, and just kind of make the whole thing even more over the top and grand and ridiculous, you know, sort of adding to the ridiculousness of this situation. Not in a sort of, so not playing funny music, which is, you know, like, I don't know, Desperate Housewives or something.
Or like Benny Hill, you know, you could just
imagine. Yeah, Benny Hill. not doing that. Yeah, exactly. So how can we, you know, have a form of music which is fun and makes it light, but also at times gives it real depth. So that was the cool thing about the choir, really, sort of wed those ideas together.
Well, I love how simple it is, because it is, like you said, it's the vocals, which are, you know, everybody can figure that out. And they've got some bells and the violins, but it's almost, you know, I always think of things like extraneously. I always super reach. It's almost like this waltz. And I think with Edward,
yeah, there is a lot of waltz. Yeah.
It's kind of like, I would say he's definitely the audience surrogate, but he's somebody who, I would say, kind of like other Guy Ritchie stories and narratives, they have the capacity to deal with the situation, but they still find themselves as an underdog, way out of their league. And so you're kind of like using the music to waltz Edward through these dangerous situations.
Yeah, that's true.
Mama Chop and Tony Blair and, you know, Stanley Johnston with a T. And I love that sort of, the air of the music is kind of taking him through through the situations. So I like
that. Yeah. I think that's true. Yeah, there's quite a bit of waltz time in there. And yeah, that sort of gives it a sort of, there's a sort of breeziness to that, and it adds, yeah, it sort of, as you say, helps him on his journey. But at the same time, it still keeps the tone of it a bit sort of over the top and sort of aristocratic somehow. Yeah.
And I just love the fact that the Dukes are in some ways beholden to their land because of this deal. And so the people who seem to be the most well off are only there because they're appointed.
Welcome to the UK.
Stress game. Yeah. Well, when I come, I'd love to see it firsthand. But it almost takes the elements that you love from, say, Richie's brand. I'm not going to say the universe, it's the brand. But then it starts to find its own lifestyle. It's inheriting a Wes Anderson theatricality to it. And so I think that's a way that you can both carry this forward without making it feel like it's something that people have seen and heard before. So all that said, you know it's this roundabout chess game. And I love this mentality that I figured out from early Richie properties. It's like everybody's working for each other, but they don't know it. And so you think of this like it's a giant circle. It's all going to come back around. So when you're working on the score, do you think in holistic approaches like that? Or do you just sort of from the hip, okay, well, this will work here and this will work here. And God, I hope they come together. If it does, well, that's cool. Because you are working with different directors too, right?
Good question. Obviously there is a holistic overview, and I think what was really nice is the first two episodes we kind of were seen as a film almost within themselves. Okay, so that's almost like a 2-hour film there, and that sort of set the precedent for the rest of the series. So and there were certain themes and little devices which then I used, hopefully, to good effect in order to do that, to suggest this sort of overarching theme of, the bigger things are at play here. Susie Glass and her dad are pulling the strings along with Eddie, So you're right. There is that was definitely sort of part of my thinking. Sometimes I just shot from the hip though and just wrote a bit of music. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it works. Well, so there's this great line. I this is where I really get geeky and stuff. So when talking to Collins, I think is his name, about boxing, talking about how they operate. And he says it's very simply, we're primordial, we're Nathandrialic, Nathandrials.
Neanderthals.
There we go.
Is that, I don't know. I'm having a stab.
It was like a history professor I had in college. He couldn't say barbarians. He would say barbareans. And to this
barbarians.
Day.
Just... Come on, dude.
But he says, we operate on three simple principles: impulse, instinct, survival. So I'm wondering that. And you were saying sometimes you shoot from the hip. So how much is it scary composing? I mean, is that an honest answer you can give me?
It is quite scary. It can be quite daunting. Especially when you've got nothing, when at the start of the process. I think like anything in life, once you're like 51% through it, it kind of takes care of itself. But that first, 50.9%, I don't know why I picked 51%, is the trickiest bit, right? It's sort of getting something to, we've sort of tipped the balance to this is good, this is working. So there are times when it is quite daunting, yes. And other times when you can really kind of feel that something good is happening in the studio. And I will at times, if I do something that I really like, I'll just kind of scream in joy. Be like, yeah, come on! After I've recorded a cello take. And then sometimes, a member of the family will come through and be like, are you okay, Dad? We heard some shouting. I was like, yeah, no, I just did a really nice little chord change and I got quite excited about it. Like, I'm quite an excitable person at times. And what's cool is that music can give you that, right? Not everyone gets that in their job. They're kind of like, come on, this is really doing it for me. That said, doesn't always mean that piece of music might end up in the final project, right? Like, I can be excited, but if Guy isn't, then he isn't. So
yeah,
I just, so sometimes I have to get rid of some babies. Yeah, which is difficult, as they say. So it can be joyous, and it can also be tricky. And often, it's to do with what the film gives you, right, or the TV series. If it gives you some trickier moments, and maybe the director's not sure about a certain scene or the way it's being acted or shot, then the music is called into question more, because it is one thing at that point in the post-production journey that you can alter. And I've seen that over my years as, you know, 15 years as a music editor as well. There's so many times when, you know, the difficult cues should actually be the easy ones, but because there's a history to that scene, or, you know, that scene's been cut out or rejigged or something at the last minute, the music becomes a real point of focus, you know, and people can become quite obsessed. And I think I always used to say that, you know, if you got, I don't know, an hour 30 film, there's probably only 6 or 7 bits of music that people will really notice. Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously there's a vibe there. There is, you know, and I think film music at its best is when it is transparent, and then at certain points really speaks to you, you know, really kind of grabs the audience. And I think that's been a great change from TV of old to the streaming TV that we know now, is that, you know, you have this longer form. So music, you know, before you know, drone shots didn't exist, right? So you couldn't have big vistas easily and cheaply. Now you can. So the whole landscape has been kind of leveled in film and TV. So now you have much more epic TV, and the music therefore can inhabit that world too. So yeah, that's a roundabout way of saying music's fun, but sometimes difficult to write.
It's a wild dance of a career. I guess as everything you do, the creatively, because you never know if it's going to land, whether in the project or in the cultural mindset afterwards, or maybe get a physical release and then people don't hear it. But more to the mindset of losing cues that you've written, what do you think is more, not to say aggravating, but what do you hate more? Do you hate that your cue is like chopped because the scene was edited, or do you hate that it's so low in a scene that you can barely hear it? Because there's a part where Ray Winstone's talking to Susie, and it's like, it's the, you know, you literally underscoring all the Ray Winstone talking. And so I'm do you want to just be like, no, people should hear my music, it was awesome?
Yeah, I think, what was the other thing? Editing. Oh. Editing versus mixing. That was the question.
Yeah, exactly. Losing it via a cut, and like no one's ever going to see it.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. That doesn't bother me, because at the end of the day, you're serving the picture, right? If the scene's not there, there's no point having a piece of music for it. But I think, it can be frustrating when the mix maybe is not what it could be, and people sort of sometimes, you know, clarity is obviously key. So yeah, sometimes, and I think, you know, it depends how loud you're listening and all those kind of things. But yeah, the mix has such a bearing on a movie and a series indeed. I mean, hopefully there's other times when the music's blaringly loud so people actually notice it. And I'm pretty sure it was a good mix in general. Yeah. So, that is a little gripe, because I mean, I listen quite loudly when I'm writing, much to my other half's dismay. Not that she can necessarily hear it, but she gets a bit worried about my hearing, which is she's very lovely of her. But I have to sort of get this visceral feedback from what I'm doing. And if the music's quiet, I just don't get that. And I think I'm so used to being in the dubbing theatre, you know, at the end of a movie, listening at ridiculously loud volume, that anything kind of less than that leaves me a bit emotionally devoid and kind of depressed. No, is this funny thing? Yeah, so I think so you're right. So the mix does have an impact on you, and yeah, you know, I think music is proven to be performance enhancing drug, isn't it? Certainly for like I do a bit of spinning, and I've tried it with and without music, and it's night and day. I think it's like scientifically proven to improve your performance by like 10% at least.
Okay,
it's pretty cool.
I wonder if the people doing those studies were listening to music to help improve their performance.
What? Hang on, you just blew my mind.
Chris Binstead lives life at 11. That's going to be the name of the podcast.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think when in terms of sound, quantity, quality, pure output, I think that people are not going to walk away from the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare without knowing music, specifically the whistling. So when it comes to something like that, You know, there are key cello players in the world. There are key bouzouki players in the world. Who are the whistlers you go to when you're like, yep, we got to do a spaghetti Western type score? That well, guy is top of my whistle list.
Well, actually, it was me, to be honest. Yeah, mate. I feel like you knew that. You just set me up there. Yeah, it's really funny, actually, because there's quite a bit of choir in it. And I hired London Voices, who are a great session choir here in London. And they did an amazing job. And chap who sort of books the singers, he said, when I sent him the demos, he's like, oh, and do you want me to get you a whistler? I was like, no, the whistling's, I mean, that's keeper, obviously. I was like, oh, no, maybe he doesn't like my whistling. But I stuck with it anyway. And it was quite tightly knit with the production. There were other things doubling it, and I'd kind of tracked it. So it was a whole deal. And I often find sometimes in those situations that you can end up chasing your tail. I'm not saying there are not great whistlers. I'm sure there are. But also my granddad, he was an awesome whistler. So I feel like it was a bit of a homage to him. I even remember, do you want to hear his tune, my granddad's tune?
Yeah, go for it.
That was his little tune. And he, in everything he did, from like peeling a potato to gardening his lawn, mowing his lawn, that's his little tune. He did it all the time.
You know what? You might have to send me a sound clip of that, because I think the sound technology actually interpreted that as music and copyrighted, and it stripped it out. I didn't hear anything.
Really?
No idea. Try it again.
That one.
No, my turn.
Is it? What
can
the
you hear me?
What is the problem with Zoom? Oh.
It's agnostic to music.
Hang on. What about this though? Check this out. If I go here, this is exciting, guys. There is a setting, isn't there? There's a setting here, guys.
Calling text upon Chris Benstead.
How about this? Original sound for musicians. How about this? Does that work?
No.
Oh my God. Okay, forget that.
I tried to play John Debney his own music, and and he was like, no, I can't hear it. So that's when I first became aware of the privacy or whatever. But this is fun.
Okay,
this is.
You can cut this bit out, mate, if you want.
Okay, so yes, that's a great great story. Ha 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 ha, I'm gonna laugh all day.
Yeah.
So we've already talked about the big band music. Let's see what else we got. Okay, Operation Postmaster. How do you know when something has a cool factor? Because that cue is just like, you could walk into a room listening to 50 Cent's PIMP, or you could walk into a room playing Operation Postmaster, and it's got that same sort of, we're gonna do this. So how do you?
Yeah. It's tempo, isn't it? It's swag. It's kind of tempo dictates a lot of stuff. You know, it's a big tool in the composer's arsenal. And for me, it's like absolutely vital. It's like the DNA of a piece of music, right? How fast is it? Because it dictates everything. So yeah, I think that cue is highly percussive, and it's in, I'm gonna say it's in 7-4. Yeah, if it's the one I'm thinking of. So that kid, and that also gives it this slightly off-kilter kind of repeatability that you get with these odd time signatures. So it kind of like messes with your melon slightly, but it's kind of an addictive kind of messing. So yeah, I think that's just about. And again, it's pretty much something that you'd play in a like a metal band, isn't it? Or like a, you know, that kind of It comes, I think, from being a guitarist to some extent, those kind of rhythms and those kind of addictive grooves.
Well, I love the answer, but I'm also going to say that I was able to hear that. So this is great. So Zoom technology has not killed all sort of face-to-face interviewing.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah.
So you had to dive into some spaghetti Western territory, some, as you said, the big band. So is there an era that seems the most difficult or more tougher to sort of pick apart as to what made the orchestration or what made that sound?
Oh, I see what you mean. Not necessarily. I mean, there's other styles of music which I'm not an expert in, obviously, and I would be more intimidated by, maybe. But I think, yeah, it sort of seemed to be in my wheelhouse, those styles to some extent. you know, stuff at the other end of the classical spectrum, which is highly virtuosic, I would, you know, I probably struggle to write a piano concerto. I'm not going to lie. You know, we all have our strengths and weaknesses. So, yeah, it's kind of knowing where you stand and not, yeah, sort of be ambitious. But also, I think, you know, Guy likes simplicity. He likes things to be visceral and not too florid and busy. He uses, you know, uses the word busy a lot. Don't be too busy here. Be less, or, you know, let's be busy, but in 3 minutes' time, kind of thing. So he's great to work with in that regard, because he has a great idea of simple, effective motifs or melodies or whatever it is. So I'm always striving for that kind of economy of means. Like, how do we make this exciting, but with the least amount of gubbins? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Being less cute with it.
Less cute, or just less overblown, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, Some of the Gentlemen is quite bombastic, but as you pointed out, it's also quite simple. It's quite pared back. It's sometimes just a waltz. It's sometimes just these stabbing staccato choirs. So that's fun to play with. And also, just hearing the space, so much film music is, well, over the last 30 years, certainly has got quite drony and quite atmospheric in nature, right? Because you can cover a lot of ground with that sort of stuff fairly quickly. Although I'm not taking that away from people who really specialize in a good sort of drone or atmospheric thing. The skill in that, people don't understand, is insane. You know, really, really some amazing stuff in that field that, again, it's not my speciality, but I definitely sort of dip into that. So I think what's also interesting is, and something I've learned from Guy, he likes gaps in things. Okay, you know, you listen, as I say, a lot of film cues, you know, you start with the carry note and that goes on for 3 minutes and you sort of work around that tone never leaves the cue. So what I kind of like to do a lot of is leave air in the music, which is what you would get in a lot of classical music to some extent, certain composers. So yeah, that's an interesting little avenue I like to go down.
You know, I think it helps keep it fresh, because, you know, if you have something, you know, you kind of get audience fatigue, or you might get a lull into thinking that, well, when the music does drop off, it's going to be impacting. So if you taper it off before the shit hits the fan, then you can kind of bring it back and it'll be more exciting. A lot like Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I'm so glad that you mentioned Guy, because there was this great, the other part of The Gentleman that I love is where Edward's being told, he says, look, I know it's all meant to be temporary. All this business with Susie Glass and her daddy, but you are fucking good at it. You know that. In fact, I think they're grooming you. And I think the same can be said for you working with Guy Ritchie. So, and I just think the trajectory and the tandem you guys have been running has been fantastic. So,
yeah, he's grooming me. Yeah. that's amazing. Yeah, it's been, you know, it's evolved into something over the last 5 or 6 years, which I wasn't expecting. You know, I never crossed my mind that I'd be writing various scores for Guy Ritchie, you know, one of the coolest ever filmmakers, let's be honest. Like, especially British filmmaker, like, I can't think of anyone who's, you know, certainly, you know, Lock, Stock and Snatch. I mean, such cultural, you know, that and Trainspotting kind of defined a decade, right? And so to be part of that and to work with someone as original as that is, you know, you have to pinch yourself, really, because he has such an extraordinary manner of thinking things in a different way to everybody else. And that's a gift, right? You know, there's not many people like that. And no matter what, even though, you know, he does some projects which are, you know, Aladdin, for example, is a big property. There's a, you know, it's a sort of tried and tested route. You know, he, you know, brings his stamp to everything. And I think his you know, his humor comes through, cuts through everything, you know.
Certainly. It cuts with really sharp teeth, but it's fun and tickles at the same time. But I think you wouldn't be in this world without coming from this world.
Oh, hello, Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit.
So this is signed by Sir Kenneth Branagh.
Oh, lovely.
Patrick Doyle. Nice. And look at you on page one. It says album edited by Chris Benstead.
That's me.
It's a nice little
thing. Oh, really?
Thing.
Yeah. Okay,
well,
cool.
I'll send you a screen clip. But you probably have one of your own. But anyway.
I'm not sure.
So I was going through your portfolio and I was like, okay, you've got the Brave, you got the Thor, you got the Planet of the Apes. Okay, so there's a Patrick Doyle connection. So he's one of our favorite guests, one of our favorite friends. In one word, what's it like working with Patrick and coming from that world?
Oh, I worked with him for quite a period and it was awesome. He's such a fun person to work with. He's hilarious. Sometimes it was difficult to do things because we were laughing so much. Like literally, but oh man, we really, you need to finish this cue, Pat. I learned so much, being on all those projects with him. And it's sort of, going back to what you were asking earlier about, is it daunting? Yeah, of course it's daunting. But what was lovely is I'd seen various composers, including Patrick, go through the process of, getting the first cut of the film, watching it through with me sometimes, oftentimes, and, watching them craft the score and watch their thought processes and what, they'd be like, oh, let's try this, Patrick, let's try this cue in this scene. And what can we do? Here's some stems. What can we do here? So really getting into that mindset of a composer, Patrick was absolutely instrumental in that. And it was a sort of apprenticeship it was sort of an apprenticeship, watching him craft these amazing scores, and he's just such a natural tunesmith and a melodic writer, and he has a real gift for reading drama as well, and just kind of and harmony. I learned a lot of things from him, how to twist something from one mood to another, and in an instant almost, without it sounding sort of cheesy. He's very adept at that sort of stuff. So it was awesome. It was a great period.
And the thing that as a film, not composer,
connoisseur.
Consumer.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
I'll give you connoisseur. I think that's even better. Yeah. Connoisseur.
But I Patrick Ryan, Thor, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, a lot of these, they only had one chance in the theaters and then we never got to hear the music again. I think that there's such thematic material that could be done in 2, 3, 4 that I would love to see his work expanded. And I mean, I know people just throw all their effort on one project and, just hope it lands. But I mean, there's just such a dense amount of work out there that it's criminal that those haven't been continued. So.
Yeah, yeah, and Aragorn, I think, is another one that he did, which was beautifully, had a great theme. There was only one film, sadly. I guess that happens. I'm hoping for an Aladdin 2. That'd be good.
Well, let's go into the speed round to get you out of here quickly so
speed
that
round.
You can get on with your day. Let's go. Favorite action film? Gun to your head. What's your favorite action film?
Whatever.
Ever.
Batman Begins.
Oh, okay. What's your favorite film score?
Did I say Back to the Future already? I've already said that. Okay, that.
that's a popular
Mr.
one.
Silvestri.
Popular.
Very popular, yeah, I know. But hey, that's me. I'm popular. Not really. Oh, God, it's gone wrong. Yeah.
Mass media. What's your favorite TV show?
Ooh. Oh, God. That's tricky. Struggling here. What's he gonna say? Of recent times, White Lotus.
Ooh, nice. Season 1 or season 2?
Season 1. 100%.
Okay. 2 was
loved it. Loved the music too. It's amazing.
But this is your speed round. I'll keep going. Hulu or Netflix?
Netflix.
Okay. Nice choice. Nice choice.
I'm gonna literally pay my mortgage, mate. So.
Favorite British pop band?
Blur.
Blur.
Yeah.
Do you remember Space?
Yeah, not as good as Blur.
No, not at all. favorite thing to do on a Saturday?
Favorite thing to do on a Saturday? Mow the lawn. Yeah, get the grass cut.
Okay.
Love it. Yeah.
That is a wild one to go out on.
You thought it was going to be something far cooler than that, didn't you?
You know, late 80s all around the raves of man. I was a top
fucking man. Yeah, yeah, boom, no, boom, not, boom. Just mow the lawn, mate. Get it done. Crack it out, because then Sunday we can then we go big, okay? We fire at the barbecue. We get the party started, okay? Saturday's about getting it ready.
Yeah. Sounds awesome.
Maybe slap on the old pizza oven as well. That's what I'm into.
Do you have an outdoor pizza oven?
Lovely little situation, yeah.
Oh, very nice. That is how the high rollers do it.
You've got to do it.
All right. Favorite Guy Ritchie property that you have and have not worked on?
I think The Gentleman, the TV series. And it's got to be Lock, Stock.
If you don't want to be counting the fingers, you should have answered that question correctly, which you did. So bravo, good sir.
Did I? Yeah.
Yes, you did. Yeah.
All right, cool.
Chris Benstead, everybody. I feel like I'm just rambling just to fill the hour, fill the time. This
is perfect.
This has been so much fun. So, all right. Yeah, well, appreciate your time. Really quickly, what else are you working on? What can we look forward to?
Another film with Guy. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is out. And the next one is The Fountain of Youth, which is an Apple TV thing. So, yeah.
All right. Fountain of Youth, everybody. All right. Well, we will thank you for your time, Chris, and we will catch you next time.